Powered by Crew Unlimited, Blue Ocean's Yachting has anchored the industry since 1982. We charter exceptional experiences across the globe. From navigating brokerage to sourcing ship-shape crew members, see the full scope of our services and answers to our most frequently asked questions at blueoceansyachting.com.
So I'll just go back to that boat that I was invited on to work on in the Caribbean in St. Thomas. So Mark was the bosun on that boat and I was the chief stew. And we were in our own cabins. Well, I was with my second stew and, well, third stew, I can't remember. And then, because I was only temporary on that boat just during that season. And we had left that boat and he had tried to pursue a relationship with me. I was not interested at all. I was interested because I'd hooked up with another deckhand or bosun who was on a boat in the Mans. And I was in love with that guy. So I wasn't interested in Mark at all. And he pursued and just kind of wouldn't take no for an answer. We had finished the season. The geese had left. The boat was in Fort Lauderdale, gone in the dry, and all the crew were let go. So we were all looking for like new boats to work on. And he had said to me, there's some yachties that have this house close to LMC shipyard. We can go stay there. So I said, okay, like I was still friends with this guy. We got on great. There was banter.
Right.
I made it clear to him that I was interested in Sam in the Med. And so we moved into this house. And I moved in believing, well, I wasn't told the whole truth, that the people that owned the house, yacht crew, there was a couple, married couple, were leaving that week to go and work on a boat in the Hamptons or up the East Coast. And that we would be alone in the house. I thought it would be no problem. Move into this house. I mean, I had my own room. He had his own room. Right. There was this other couple. So I thought it would be fine. And then we were, you know, Mark had gone for an interview on a boat, Penny May in Sunrise Marina, and had been offered the job. So I thought, perfect. He's going to be off. I'll be in the house. I'll get a job soon. There's no problem. Mark came home one Friday. I was 33. And it was my birthday. I was turning 33 on the Monday. And the Friday, Mark came home from the boat. He had just been offered the job. He'd gone for the interview in Sunrise, been offered the job, came back home. And he said, get in the car, you're going to go for an interview. I said, where? What are you talking about? He said, Penny May, I've got you an interview for Chief Stew on the boat. And I said, Mark, I don't want to work with you. I told you, absolutely not. Like, I don't want to work with you anymore. Sam wouldn't like that. It's okay, thank you. And he screamed at me and told me, get in the car. Don't embarrass me. Go for the interview. So I thought, all right, I'll go for the interview. No problem. I'll just do a really bad interview and no problem.
Right, right.
Well, the captain of that boat showed me around, spoke to me briefly, and I was not interested at all. The boat was really small and I was just like, I didn't want to work on the boat at all. And then he said to me before I left, he said, can you start on Monday? And I was like, well, what do you mean? He's like, well, you've got the job, Chief Stew. Can you start on Monday? And thank God it was my birthday on the Monday. So I had that little excuse. And I said, well, it's my birthday on Monday and I've got all these plans. And I've got friends coming in for the week. So can I get back to you later next week? Knowing quite well that I have no plans to take that job.
For sure.
So he said, no problem. He understood. I left. Well, Mark and I left, got in the car. And on the way back to that house, he screamed and shouted and swore at me and told me that I have to take the job. I can't embarrass him. He risks losing his job as first officer if I don't take the job as chief stew. Anyway, I was like, don't be ridiculous. It'll be fine. And I thought nothing of it. Like, I thought that was it. I had arranged my birthday party. We were going to Blue Martini, I think, Tap 42 and then Blue Martini on Saturday
two
night. And I'd sent out messages to yacht crew that I knew, friends of mine that were in the area, and had this whole Saturday night planned. Saturday afternoon, I was sitting on my laptop talking to my friend who was in Brazil. At the time, I just moved to Brazil. We were on Skype in those days. And Mark got back. It was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. He had gone for a run or to gym. I had no idea. And he walked in and he started screaming and shouting at me, like going ballistic. And I was like, are you, like, what's going on? And he was, I don't even want to use the profanities, but it was really bad. And I said to my friend, Lindy, I said, oh, Lindy, I'll speak to you later. Bye. And I just closed my laptop. I said, Mark, calm down. Look, have a good day. We're going to go out tonight for my party. Everything is going to be okay. Just chill. I picked up my laptop, went to my bedroom and put the laptop on my bed and picked up my phone. And then he came in screaming and shouting. I stood at the door screaming and shouting, all abuse, that I have to take this job. I'm embarrassing him. Just, it was really bad. And I remember like stepping down, like sitting down, putting my head against my arm on the bed, putting my head in my hand and going, Mark, please just stop. Just stop. And then he came in and he leant over me and he started stroking my head and going, it's okay, baby. Everything's going to be okay. And I remember thinking, this is sociopathic. There's something not right here. It's split personality. He's gone from calling me an effing everything to it's okay, baby. Something's chemically not balanced here. So I picked up my phone off the bed and I ran to the bathroom and I thought I'll lock myself in the bathroom and make a phone call, ask for someone to come and just get me out of this. I'll go stay in a crew house, go stay somewhere else. Before I could lock the bathroom door, he kicked it. I went flying back and hit the ceramic bathtub on my head on the ceramic tub and like was just like in absolute shock. And he stood at the door of that bathroom, again, screaming and shouting. And I was scared. I was really scared. So I stood up and I'd left my phone on the floor. I stood up to like walk out and just like get past him. And he, as I was getting up, he lifted me up and he shook me and he shook me and shook me so hard. And I just heard this and I was like delirious. I didn't know what had happened. I have no idea. It like, and then I felt the pain. And I looked, and he was still shaking me through all of this. And I looked down and my bone was sticking out. It didn't pierce through the skin, but he had dislocated my right shoulder.
Wow.
And through all that shaking, he had ripped all my tendons and ligaments as well. And I screamed with pain. I'd never broken a thing in my life before. And I said, you've broken my arm. And he said, you dumb bitch. You've done this to yourself, whatever. And I started hyperventilating and panicking out of trauma and fear.
Wow.
And everything. And I like dropped to the floor and he walked out and he came back with 3 Advil PMs and he shoved them in my mouth and he said, have these for the pain. So I took them because I was in pain and I didn't think like, oh, well, can I have the Advil instead of the PM version?
Right.
So Advil PM, for those that are not American, it's the nighttime painkiller that you would take.
3 of them will put you out.
Which knocks you out instantly. So you only need one. And I was so delirious, but in so much pain. I couldn't move. I mean, my bone was sticking out. It was traumatic. And I said to him, please, I've got to call an ambulance or a taxi. I need to go to the hospital. And he said, I'll take you. Get in the car. So I literally like held my arm up with the bone sticking out, walked over to the car, and he took me to Broward. When we got there, because, I mean, they could see visually my arm and I suppose the trauma in my face, they took me straight through to the trauma unit.
Yeah.
I don't remember the rest. I remember waking up about 6-7 hours later because it was dark at that stage, 7-8 o'clock at night, and so delirious in bed. The doctors and nurses standing around me and Mark to my right, sitting on the injured side with his hand on my lap. And I remember saying to the doctor, he broke my arm. He broke my arm. And the doctor said, it's okay. Your shoulder was dislocated, but it's okay now. It's in a sling. We relocated it. We've given you morphine and Vicodin. You're going to be okay. And I said, okay. And then they asked me to sign something. I mean, I couldn't even read what I was signing. I was so delirious. I was under duress because I was scared because the guy that had done this to me was like had literally had his hand on my lap. I didn't know what the doctors knew. I was scared. And he kept on saying during the conversation with them, like, everything's going to be okay. I'm going to take you home. Everything's going to be okay. Silly accident. And so I was scared. I was shit scared to say anything. So they released me and we got back in the car and drove home. And of course, that was the night of my birthday party. So right. I said to him, I said, Mark, where's my phone? I need my phone. I've got to phone all these people and like cancel the party. I've got to called Blue Martini and he said, you're not getting your phone back. He said, you have done this to yourself. If you tell anyone, I will fucking kill you.
Psycho.
He didn't give me my phone back. I was too scared to be in my bedroom. So I was in the lounge at that time, like watching TV, just hoping for him to go to bed. And I thought I would start looking for my phone. And while I was in the lounge, he kept on making me repeat, I've done this to myself. I've done this to myself. And I did repeat it because I just wanted to keep, I forgot the most pertinent part. He sat there polishing his diving knife. So he took it out the leather strap thing it was in and he was literally polishing it, making me repeat, I've done this to myself. Eventually I went to bed Sunday. I sat in bed all day. I mean, I was in so much pain. I do remember going to the bathroom and trying to shower with a sling. And he walked in and I said, get out. And he's like, I'm here to help you. And there I am naked with a sling on, very compromised, vulnerable, shit scared. And he like barged into the bathroom and wanted to like wash me. So anyways, that was Sunday. Still didn't have my phone back. Monday was my birthday. And I begged him for my phone. I said, my father in South Africa is going to be calling me and friends. I need my phone. And he still would not give me my phone. But on Monday, he needed to go back to Sunrise to speak to the captain. And he said he was going to tell the captain that I've broken my arm and he needs to look after me for a few days. Because obviously he knew at this stage that he didn't want me to leave the house or be on the boat and the possibility of me leaving. During this time, during that weekend, he bought like double locks and bolts. And every time he left the house, he would lock me in from the outside. So it was a ground floor house. There were no stairs. And you could lock the doors from the inside from the key. With a key. There were burglar guards like outside the lounge and stuff. The only windows that didn't have burglar guards were the kitchen above the kitchen sink. But every time he had left or whatever, he would, or even when he was at home with me, he would like bolt and double lock and had this whole.
See, he confined you.
Completely confined me. And so the Monday he wanted to go back to the boat to speak to the captain and he asked me to go with and sit in the car in like ridiculous heat. It was September. And I said, no, I said, I'm so tired. I'm on Vicodin, which I was, and I'm just going to go to sleep. Because I knew that was the only window, opportunity that I had to escape. So he left. He said, okay, I'll be back in like half an hour. So I said, perfect, I'm just going to go to sleep. So I played along, fell asleep, but didn't really fall asleep. And then literally watched him drive away. I was looking out the blinds in the lounge. And then I started frantically trying to open. That's when I realized that he had locked me from the outside in as well. And that's when I realized the only window of escape. And I knew that I had to find my phone. So I went into his room and there was the diving knife polished out of its strap, the sheath or I don't know what you call it. And I searched for my phone. Eventually I found my phone sandwiched between his clothes in a suitcase, picked it up. 2% battery life. I was like, fuck. I thought of one person I would phone, and that was my chef that had worked with me on Party Girl, who lived up in Boynton Beach. I called him and I said, this is the address. You need to be here immediately. Someone is trying to kill me. He said, I'll be there in 20 minutes. I took the phone. I went to the kitchen. I left all my things. I struggled to jump up with my sling. Absolute pain and jumped out the window with a sling and just like my shoulder and all that pain. It was horrific. Ran across the street and hid behind a massive oak tree, waiting, trembling, petrified that Mark would come home.
Right.
My chef arrived with his girlfriend at the time in their Jeep. I jumped out from the tree. I told him to go in what had happened, to go get my suitcase. I stayed in the car with his girlfriend, Marlo, at the time, and he got my stuff, got in the car, and we drove back to his place. In that car, in that trip up, Mark had got home and realized I was gone. And he tried to phone me, I didn't answer, and he sent me texts, and he said, if you tell anyone what I've done to you, I'm going to fucking kill you. So I went to my friend's condo, stayed there for a couple of days. He took me to the Fort Lauderdale police to have this guy arrested and press charges. And the police said to me, they can't arrest him because there was no gunshot wound. There was no injury from a stabbing. It's just a dislocated shoulder. And Mark had, on the medical records, he had said that I'd fallen downstairs and broken my shoulder.
Single floor,
not one stair in the entire place. So anyway, so the police couldn't do anything.
You got the wrong protect.
But my chef could. So the owner that we worked for was very good friends with the sheriff of the state. So a couple of calls were made. I had the Florida state advocate supporting me. And a temporary restraining order that week was served to Mark on the boat Penny May. I think there were like 8 cops and 3 German Shepherd dogs and blackout jeeps and everything.
It was the attention they definitely don't want.
It was crazy. And I remember them saying to me, when's the best time to serve him the restraining order? And I said, 10 o'clock, that's crew tea break. All the crew on the dock smoking. So we went there at 10 o'clock. I stayed in the car with one of the policewomen. And the others, with their dogs, walked down that dock while all the crew were on their tea breaks on that dock and went on board and served him the restraining order, temporary restraining order and notice to serve in court. The captain came out to the blackout car with me and the cop and just shook his head and said, I can't believe this. He said you fell down the stairs and broke your arm and you were back in London with your father. I said, no, this is what happened. He was fired immediately from the boat.
Of course.
And the court case was the end of September. So we went to court eventually, and I had the state advocate and myself, and Mark went in. Well, when he turned up, I didn't even recognize him. He looked completely different. His hair was combed in a completely different style. He even brought in a briefcase. I mean, this was 2011, like no one carried briefcases anymore. I was like, did he get that from a thrift store? Like he just looked so bizarre with like a different shirt and like chinos. And that wasn't even Mark. And anyway, we went in and the judge served him a 3-year restraining order, which was the maximum restraining order offered for what he had done to me. And then Mark had said to the judge there, do you have any questions? And he said, yes, sir. Get a restraining order against her. And the judge literally laughed at him and said, there's not a scratch on you. Look at the state of her. She's black and blue, bruised. She's got a sling.
Yeah.
She can see she's traumatized. You look quite healthy and like not a scratch on you. Absolutely not. So that was it. Part of the restraining order was his family and his friends can't harass me. Well, I still got harassed by his family, friends that I'd never heard of, which phoned my phone, threatened me, all this sort of stuff. The state advocate actually wanted to put me in a safe house. She had said to me, he is textbook sociopath, and right, don't be surprised if you don't see him on TV on the news.
Wow. Wow.
So it was scary. So she wanted to put me in a safe house. I declined. I went and stayed with friends in Colorado, whose neighbor was the FBI, so I felt somewhat safe. And I was there for 6 months.
So that he took you out of yachting for 6 months?
He took me out of yachting, traumatized me. It was absolutely horrific. During the time, before the court case even, the chef had said to me, has he done this before? And I said, I don't know. I hardly know the guy. But I remember him talking about his ex-wife, who was also in the yachting industry. She worked for recruitment in Fort Lauderdale, who was in San Diego at the time. And the chef had said, well, why don't you reach out to her and see if she's done this? So I tracked her down on Facebook, sent her a message, and she said, oh my God, what's your number? I'm going to call you. She called me immediately. We were on the phone for about 3 hours, and she told me a very similar story. She had been looking for him. She had served him a restraining order. He had abused her physically and their dog. And he had fled San Diego back to Fort Lauderdale. And apparently the cops had actually been looking for him in San Diego. And she was like, thank you so much. You've actually taken us right to him. So that was that story.
Wow. Wow.
5 years later, I was in India, staying in an ashram because I was doing my 500 hours yoga teacher training. And out the blue, I get a message on Messenger from this lovely woman called Jamie. And she says, you don't know me, but I am the mother of Mark's child. I've got a few questions for you I'd like to ask. Has he ever hurt you?
Else. Wow.
5 years later.
So he's an abuser.
He's an abuser. I connected with her. She told me her story. Of course, the same story he told me about the ex-wife is what he told Jamie, that we're the crazy ones and we asked for it. And we exaggerated. Exactly. It was a pattern.
Isn't that textbook? So you and I talked previous to this conversation a little bit about this kind of thing, because it goes back to your description of crew and the environments we come into. And then you have people like Mark that show up and they find ways of moving to another boat, another place, another location. I know Rhea, our producer, has been chasing a gentleman that has been evading justice, has recently found his justice in Broward County,
yeah,
which I think is it's a positive thing. Is there a solution to this? I've been involved in some conversations somewhat recently about trying to come up with mandatory background checks. And I'm going to put a little color into this in that when I was in yacht management and we were placing crew, top right-hand corner photograph oftentimes indicated whether the crew was going to be off of the job, shallow, but real. But at the time, background check wasn't a mandatory thing. In fact, it was and probably still is in most cases a line item that check this line item, pay additional €250 or $250 for a service level background check, where you can spend €1,500, $2,000,
yeah,
for a in-depth background check. Rarely happen. How do you find these marks? How do you find these people that are beyond toxic? Because we're going to talk about Alchemy, the book you wrote, in a moment here, because this is not your only traumatic experience in yachting. I'm sorry to kind of pull that into the conversation, but I think it's important. But before we go to Alchemy and to Jess, any thoughts that you would like to share about how you find these marks?
So the idea of a background check, a police check, is great, but timing, I think, is the problem. Often in yachting, between charters, someone could fall and break their leg or sprain their wrist, or they just burnt out, or someone at home has died and they have to leave. And then the captain or the chief stew will call the crew agent and go, I need a chief stew immediately tomorrow, flown in. So with that, there's no time to do a background check or a criminal check, peace report. Also, I think a lot of crew in the industry have dual nationality, South Africans with a South African passport and a British passport. So what criminal check have they had? What criminal check are they providing the crew agent if there was one? Their clean British history or their dirty South African one? So that would be another consideration. So I don't know how easy it would be to have background checks.
And on your CVs, normally placement agencies go through your CVs and they make phone calls to the previous captains or owners.
Yeah.
And if you know you had a problem on a particular boat, you just don't put that on your CV.
Exactly.
You either a time void in there, or you embellish the time you were between two boats, yeah, so that it doesn't show that you're off a boat for any long period,
yeah,
of time. And so you're calling boats that had no particular experience that was a negative experience.
Exactly.
While the incidental situation goes unfound because it's not,
yeah,
part of the documents that go for your vetting process.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think background checks are very important, but the logistics of it, I don't know how that would work with the way the industry is run and like quick turnarounds and flying crew in last minute. But I think psychological testing would be very important and is doable. I mean, pilots have psychological tests,
yes,
to be hired, because they put other people's lives,
right,
in their
hands.
We don't want
pilots running into mountainsides to,
exactly,
make a
statement. So why aren't crew who are surrounded and living and working with other crew people, why aren't they psychological tests for us?
I thought we should.
I think that's the way to go, psychological testing.
Yeah. No, that horrific experience. Thanks for sharing that. No excuses for that. And the fact that it happened in my hometown is, you know, disturbing on its,
yeah,
own. A lot to unpack in all of this. And I think it was good. We just took a quick break you were telling me off camera that you, coming out of your experience with Mark, it didn't get smooth sailing again. You joined another boat and you had a situation where someone actually came into your cabin.
Yeah. Same problem, different accents.
Different accents.
So after 6 months up in Colorado, recovering and doing extensive physiotherapy and just recovering from the trauma of what had happened with Mark, I wasn't sure if I wanted to go back to yachting, but I did because I love the industry. I love the people. I've got more good memories in yachting than I had bad memories in yachting.
Sure, sure.
So it wasn't going to deter me. I wasn't going to let one bad seed ruin my apple, so to speak. So I decided to continue my career in yachting, which I did. And a few years later, I was back on Icon, which was that first boat that I was...
Right, right.
...that I joined as second stew years later with many boats in between as chief stew. The captain called, same captain, called me back and said, I've got this perfect job for you. The boat's going into the shipyard in Harlingen for a 3-month refit. We're extending the stern by 5 meters, putting in a swimming pool, and I want to invite you back on board as interior manager / purser. And I was actually in Tulum on vacation at the time doing a yoga juice detox retreat
right.
for 10 days. And I remember thinking, oh gosh, no, I don't know if I want to be stuck in a shipyard in Holland, in the Netherlands during winter. It was January. So I declined a few times and then eventually I thought, you know what, just go for it. What's the worst that could happen? If I don't like it, I'll just leave and move on to another boat. And I hadn't done an extensive shipyard period like that. And I was moving up the ladder from chief stew to interior manager, purser. So I thought that would look really good on my resume and to career step up,
yep.
which would be the last step in my career in yachting because I had no plans to become a captain. So interior manager, purser is the top of the game. So
that's
I thought, okay, I could definitely do that. So he flew me in from Cancun to Netherlands and I joined the boat in the shipyard. 3 months refit ended up being 9 months.
But no surprise.
You know what, Rick? That was the best experience in my yachting career.
I'm not surprised to hear that either.
I never thought I would.
You learned a lot.
I learned a lot and I got an understanding of how the shipyard works and boat building.
Yeah.
And of course, we got new owners. They were charter guests that had come on Icon before. And the Russian oligarch said, I want boat, I want shipyard. And
the shipyard
he bought the shipyard
Icon,
too.
Yeah.
And but at that time, those 9 months, I just loved it. So we would have like weekly meetings with the naval architects and the Icon shipyard. And they were great guys. And I loved it. And then, of course, when we went into the shipyard, we went down to skeleton crew. And so I was, again, responsible for recruiting 24 new crew
wow.
on the boat, apart from the chief engineer, the captain.
You also got to use some of your Dutch language skills, too.
Yes,
you?
I didn't know that my Afrikaans from high school would ever come in handy. But all of a sudden, it just came out and I could read the signs. And I was all of a sudden hosting these weekly shipyard meetings with the naval architects and the builders and my Russian oligarch who couldn't speak Dutch and my captain who was British couldn't speak Dutch. And there I was, all of a sudden, translators. So it was a great experience. And of course, being in the shipyard, we had crew houses ashore. So we got the best of both worlds, a bit
sure.
of shore life, living a normal life in a condo, in apartments and houses, and then having weekends off, not having to work. So, and then as interior manager, I was responsible for refitting the interior.
Right.
Assisting with the artwork, new decor, those white silk carpets.
Only we had a replace, yeah.
And yeah, it was honestly one of the best moments in my yachting career was actually, and I know when crew are hired to go and work in a shipyard and do a shipyard period, it puts a lot of crew off. Because they don't want, you know, you become crew to work on a yacht to be on turquoise waters in the Caribbean or sailing through the Med. So it puts a lot of crew off, but I can honestly say you learn a lot in your shipyard boat building.
Yeah.
And to put that on your CV, it shows that you've got grit and that you can, you know, you're not just there for sunshine and Skittles.
Well, you have additional value you can bring to the table as well.
Yeah.
Because that shipyard period happens on every yacht, at least every 5 years.
Exactly.
And some of them are just, you know, short period. Some of them, that's the opportunity to do the major renovations or the extensions or big refits. So
yeah.
to have on your CV that you're participating in, that was a very major refit.
Yeah,
meter extension.
It was. And yeah. putting in a swimming pool and yeah. everything was phenomenal. So we left the shipyard that September, went straight to the Monaco Boat Show. And that was another great, I love boat show.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of crew also don't like boat shows because it's show and tell and it's,
yeah.
you know, flying and everything. But it's a lot of fun because you meet a lot of people in the industry. It's good for networking. And mm-hmm. yeah, boat shows are actually really, I would encourage crew to do boat shows and to stick through them. I've done quite a few. So after that period of the boat show, we then crossed the Atlantic again. I've done about 7 Atlantic crossings in my life in my 9 years and two equatorial crossings. And we went back to the Caribbean and then it was time to sort of promote the boat. So I had vacation. I went to Australia. I took 2 months off. As interior manager, I was allowed 60 days off, which was great. So during that time, I was actually still working because we were going to the Antigua boat show. That would be the boat was crossing over to go to Antigua.
Yeah.
And as you know, every year there's an Antigua boat show. And
it's in December usually, right?
Yeah. Start about the 14th of December. And every year at the end of the boat show, there's an event called the Yacht Hop.
Yes.
Where 150 yachts are docked. And there's one night for a couple of hours where the brokers, the agents, potential owners, whoever in the industry walk around and they go on each vessel, they meet the crew and the boat is presented. The
right.
crew is presented the boat. And you basically want to show your potential charter brokers, you want them to book guests, charter guests
right.
to come on your boat, because obviously we get charter terms, which is another huge perk in the industry, which
Absolutely.
Is why I continued so long in the industry. And so while I was in Australia on that vacation, I was organizing a boat show, a party. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Cirque du Soir party. That was me. So I'd organized everything. I'd ordered the outfits, the DJ, the live band, everything. So we put on the Cirque du Soir show that night. Well, 149 boats in that dock shut down their parties because no one was on their boat. We had about 450, 500 people on board of that boat. I remember the dock was just shoes. Everyone's shoes before they came on board. It was absolutely phenomenal.
That's amazing.
But it was a blessing and a curse because from that event that I put on, we secured 17 back-to-back charters.
Oh, ow.
That following mid-season. So the crew were absolutely burnt out, but we got phenomenal tips and amazing charters. We had some phenomenal...
I'm smiling.
Because I'm thinking of the celebrities that came on board and... just the people and the tips and what we got from that. So although we have the burnout and the isolation and all that stuff that I bitch and moan about, there's such a good side to it as well. If there's a balance in it.
Yeah.
And if you can get that balance right, that's good.
Right.
And that's when I think it's imperative that the captain and management see that the crew are working 17 back-to-back charters, give them time off.
Right.
Give them rest time, you know?
Yeah.
So we had finished that Caribbean season, went to the Med, done that Med season with the 17 back-to-back charters. So we were all tired. We were exhausted and finished that Med season. Then we were back in the Caribbean 6 months later and the boat was preparing to do a crossing to go back to the Med. And I was on watch on the Friday night because I was flying up to Bali for my 2 month vacation on the Saturday. So I was like, I'll do watch, no problem. You crew go out because I knew that they were all going to be doing the crossing for the next 17 days and I was going to be off the boat and I needed to pack and sort things out. So the crew went out. I finished my watch schedule at 10 p.m., climbed into bed, very excited to walk to Bali tomorrow. And about 5 o'clock in the morning, Saturday morning, my door opens to my cabin. I had my own cabin and the chef stumbles in, Corey, Australian chef. Absolutely off the space, drunk and whatever else he was on, and sits on my bed. I'm in bed in my like half naked pajamas. And I'm like, what are you doing? And he's like leaning over me and I can smell his like alcohol breath. And I was like, Corey, get out my cabin. It was really difficult because I had hired his fiance to be my chief stew.
Okay,
who was my friend and a chief student. No, she came on first.
Oh, she came on first.
And she was on board for about a year, and our chef had left to go and open up a provisioning company or something ashore. And we had an open chef position. So she had asked if her fiance, Corey, could come on board as chef. And I was, well, the captain actually was like, no, we don't want couples on board. So the no couple boat for obvious reasons because of the stabbing with the Leatherman before. Uh-huh. So he had a bad experience. And I convinced that captain, let him come on board, give him a go, give him a chance. It's Becky's fiance, shame. It's her fiance. You know how hard it is. It's not like they're a new couple. Or they're
right,
just dating.
They're established.
They're getting married. They're planning a wedding. So I twisted the captain's arm and we got Corey on board. And he had been on board for about 6 months. So, and this is the chef that barges into my cabin at 5 o'clock in the morning, breathing over me with this rum breath and getting a bit too close. And I said, Corey, get out numerous times, like screaming on top of my lungs. Now, everyone else is sleeping or still out, I don't know. And it's quite insulated, the sound and stuff, so no one would have heard me. And he wouldn't move, he wouldn't get off my bed. And eventually I said, Corey, I'm calling the captain. And he didn't believe me. I picked up the phone, I raised the alarm, I called the captain, the chief engineer, all the other HODs, captain, chief engineer, chief officer. I said, meet me in the bridge. Well, they were absolutely pissed off with me because at this stage, it's 5:20 in the morning, Saturday morning, their first day in a whole season.
Opportunity to sleep a little bit.
Yeah. And there's their interior manager who's buggering off to Bali for 2 months, calling them, waking them up at 5:30. So they met me in the bridge and I told them what had happened. And I said, not acceptable. I felt unsafe, violated, invasion of privacy, awkward because it's my chief student's fiance. I don't know who saw him going in, going out. I don't want to be accused of anything. Like, not okay. Captain shrugged it off. At the time, while we were all in the bridge having this meeting, Corey was like stumbling on the dock and smoking and whatever. The first officer went down and called him. He had come up to the bridge. I had said, Corey, can you please explain to the guys what's just happened here? And he didn't deny it. He was like so drunk. And I remember he picked up a pen and threw it at my captain.
That's not good.
No, it's not. It's completely out of hand. So I would have thought that with that violation to the captain, that the captain would have got him off immediately. But he didn't. Apparently, I said, oh, this needs to be logged in the logbook. I want this logged in the logbook. This is not okay. This is not just a once. We need to document this. And the first officer said, it's too much red tape.
Okay.
And anyway, at this stage, I had to get my stuff. Like, I was going to Bali, so I had to go down, pack, leave, fly off to Bali. And in the meantime, I had been in constant communication with the captain, asking him, like, what's happening with Corey? I said, I'm not coming back to this boat in 6 weeks if Corey's still on the boat. This was not safe. It's not comfortable. So, like, we need to lead by example. Because if you let your head chef do this to the interior, to another HOD, what's the deckhand going to do? To the stewardess.
Yeah.
You know,
there's precedent away.
Exactly. So long story short, not much happened. The captain did apparently speak to the owners and the Russian oligarchs, and they were like, we'll deal with it after the mid-season. Let her come back from Bali, do the mid-season. We'll finish the mid-season together, and then we'll sit down and deal with it. We like his food. Meanwhile, I've been on the boat for 4 years. Right. I'd done the research. I was interior manager, convinced the captain to hire him.
Right.
And they liked his food. And they just wanted me to keep quiet and deal with it at the end of the Caribbean season. And after what I'd gone through with Mark, I couldn't put myself in that position again. In fairness, nobody on that boat knew what I'd gone through with Mark because I have not shared my Mark story until this last month.
Okay.
I've kept it quiet. I've kept silent.
So I guess this is a segue.
Well, let me just finish the extent of this. So nothing happened to Corey. They kept him on board the boat. I then reached out to the DPA, the designated person ashore, to ask for help, explain the situation that I wasn't looked after, that I feel unsafe in my environment. Nothing happened. I was encouraged to leave, to resign. I didn't. I went to a doctor and got medical letter for medical leave. They wanted to put me on Xanax and whatever. I don't take pharmaceuticals, so I didn't. But I was like, because I thought I could buy myself time until the end of the end of that mid season and get my job back. I didn't want to lose my job. Why should I lose my job as interior manager? Because I was violated and sexually harassed.
You should not.
So I sort of left quietly, still employed, but wasn't on board the boat, waiting for the season to finish up. During that time, the boat was in Ibiza. The crew had a night off. The crew went out. Corey was out in the streets of Ibiza, ended up getting arrested by the police in Ibiza for harassment and violence. He was brought back to the boat. He had to pack his bags and he was deported back to Australia.
Carlos.
So the trash took itself out.
The trash took itself out.
However,
still, you didn't get justice.
I didn't get justice and I didn't go back to the boat.
What did the DPA step in, do anything?
Nothing.
I think that is something that's also misunderstood in our industry, in that a lot of crew think that the role of the DPA is to look after, help look after the crew.
In hindsight, that's what he's meant to do.
Actually, it's not their real role, though. Their primary role is to look after the asset for the owner.
And, yeah.
And so they report to the owner and the captain, and then if they take their marching orders that way.
Yeah.
That is, I think, one of the holes that exist in the industry.
Yeah.
This is where crew need to be aware that, you know, depends on the DPA, it depends on the owner, it depends on the whole program.
Yeah.
Some of them are very good. I'm sure you've worked on boats that were really well managed and well run, and the DPA probably would have been a strong advocate, but not always. And maybe it was because they were working for the Russian oligarch, and the Russian oligarch had his vision of how it should be done.
And the agencies are getting paid by the Russian oligarch. So who are they going to listen to?
Of course, follow
the liability on board with a big mouth or... Yeah.
So like you said, the trash took himself out.
Yeah, exactly. So that kind of worked out, but I didn't go back.
He allowed to be on that boat for a while.
Or he got fired.
Well,
he eventually got
between what he did to you and then when he got fired from Ibiza, he was still on board.
Oh, he was still on board, exactly.
More opportunity for bad behavior.
Yeah. And who knows if he did that to another woman on board? I have no idea. I still don't know if his fiance, now wife, knows what actually happened.
Wow.
I have no idea. Again, another story I never told.
Yeah. No, I'm glad we're talking. I'm glad you're telling these stories. I think they're important. They're necessary. And you certainly have voiced such a love for the industry, you know, to also to be in the space you're in, you know, sharing these experiences.
Mm.
I apologize for interrupting a few minutes ago, because I do want to make sure we have an opportunity to talk about something that I know is really important. It's in the book you wrote, Alchemy. Again, it's another shameless plug. It's a great book. You write very well.
Thank you.
And the stories are poignant and raw, and I think worthy of read. But we also experienced a situation a couple months ago at Harbor Island in Bahamas with a lovely South African woman by the name of Paige Bell, who was murdered on board a boat. And that was part of the energy that brought us together, you know, the outrage you felt, you know, reading of another South African woman. You were featured in a newspaper article in South Africa.
So when the Paige Bell story landed, it was incredibly triggering for me.
Sure.
Because not only was it 2 weeks before the 8-year anniversary of Jess's murder, it was just too close to home.
Yeah.
South African stewardess on a yacht. And I just thought, well, that could have been me.
Sure.
It could have been me with Corey. It could have been me with Mark. It could have been me with other incidences that I've had as well that I never spoke about at the time, because I had this fear and I didn't want to be blacklisted at the time in the industry, because I didn't know that would be my last time in the industry. I didn't decide yet if I was leaving.
Right.
So, you know, to protect your, it's almost like the, you can't say anything. You can't speak up.
You're tied into some NDAs when you sign on too,
absolutely,
aren't you?
Absolutely. We sign NDAs so we can't talk. I honestly feel that the NDA protects the owner, the boat, the management, and not actually the crew.